This podcast is supported by The Real Real.
You know what I love most about the holidays? Giving gifts. But not just any gifts. Real gifts. Thoughtful gifts. Oh my God, how did you know gifts? That's why I love gift shopping with The Real Real. The Real Real is the most trusted name in authenticated luxury resale. And it's a holiday shopping secret I'm going to let you in on. Whether it's a surprisingly affordable, pristine condition bag for your BFF, a vintage find that's cool enough for the Gen Zer in your life, or even something your impossible to shop for dad will love. Get used to saying, I found it on The Real Real. Seriously, with over 10,000 new arrivals dropping every day from brands like Gucci, Fendi, Prada, Louis Vuitton, Tiffany & Co., and Cartier, there's guaranteed to be something for everyone on your list. Oh, and did I mention everything's up to 90% off retail?
Get $25 off your first purchase at TheRealReal.com. That's TheRealReal.com to get your $25 off. TheRealReal.com.
At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.
Hey y'all, I'm Carrie.
I'm Mama.
And this is Monstrous. This episode contains topics and language that may not be suitable for all listeners. And topics that may be triggering to some. Listener discretion is advised.
I just want to say I hope everybody had a happy and safe Thanksgiving.
Sorry, trying to fix my giant blanket here. Don't give me that look.
You lie, dude.
Whatever. Anyway, rude. Okay, we're back. We're opening up December.
Yay.
Yeah. Well, we're not. Like right this second. But
that will be.
Right. We're ahead. Right. So as the year winds down, we have just 5 episodes left in 2025. And we are officially moving into the final, often complicated stretch of the holiday. Today, we are confronting a case where the Christmas spirit was twisted into a final, profound symbol of isolation. One that is tied directly to the heart of Christmas. A Christmas tree.
I think some people would argue that point with you.
What do you mean?
The point of Christmas is not a Christmas tree.
Well, I say the heart of Christmas because Christmas time everywhere, it's Christmas tree.
Well, I understand that.
Yeah, and that's why I said at the heart of it, obviously, it's about more than just a Christmas tree, but you can't have Christmas without a Christmas tree.
Yeah. I don't have to have a Christmas tree.
You don't have to because you live here and we have one.
Well, even when I got my first apartment ever, before Kim and I,
right,
when Kim and I split up, who, by the way, is my ex-husband now.
Didn't make that known.
I wasn't gonna put a tree up in my house.
Like, obviously you can still have.
I worked and I was at work so much.
Right. Like, obviously you can still do Christmas without a Christmas tree. Like, I don't mean like literally you can't have Christmas without a Christmas tree. What I mean.
Presents is another story.
Like, everywhere you look at Christmas time are trees.
Well, that's true. And wreaths made out of trees.
Right. Exactly. So. Really, at the heart of Christmas is a giant pine tree.
And they melt so good.
I know. I love the way. Anyway, that's not what. Anyway, sorry, guys. So today we're going to close the book on a mystery that lingered for a quarter century.
Dang.
The tragic, meticulously planned end of a woman known for decades as the Christmas tree lady.
Wouldn't she do dress up like a Christmas tree?
No.
Okay.
The mystery centers not only on who she was, but on the profound symbolic items that she left behind. A small Christmas tree, comedy cassettes, and the defining emotional context of her life, documented in the unpublished manuscript that she wrote titled The Target Child.
Okay.
This case spans 41 years from her last contact with family in 1981 until just 3 years ago in 2022.
Dang.
The mystery of this case was never who killed her, but who she was, and perhaps more profoundly, why she chose such a specific symbolic way to disappear. This case struck people because it wasn't about a murder. It was about a woman trying to disappear, yet still leaving symbols that beg to be understood. So the discovery was made on December 18, 1996, at Pleasant Valley Memorial Park Cemetery in Annandale, Virginia. Okay. So Pleasant Valley Memorial Park is the kind of cemetery most people drive past without ever noticing. It's quiet, modest, and tucked away behind neighborhoods, shaded by old trees that stay bare and gray throughout the winter. The children's section, where Joyce chose to die, feels strangely frozen in time. Tiny headstones lined in neat rows, many decorated with weathered toys, little trinkets, and faded holiday ornaments left by grieving parents. Even in December, when the ground is hard and the air is sharp, this place carries a strange softness with it. It's a place heavy with innocence, which makes her choice of location even more. To this day, investigators aren't sure how Joyce discovered Pleasant Valley Memorial Park. There's no record of her ever having a connection to Annandale, nor any evidence she visited the cemetery before the day she died. But what they do believe is that her choice was deliberate. This location wasn't random. It was purposeful. She had to have scouted it ahead of time, walking through the quiet rows of infant and child graves before deciding that this, of all places, was where she wanted her life to end. So whether she chose it for its symbolism, its privacy, or the sense of innocence she felt there, no one knows. But it was a choice she made with absolute intention. And although investigators still don't know why she chose Annandale specifically, there are theories. The Washington, D.C. region has always been a transient area, filled with travelers, government workers, and people passing through from every corner of the country. It's a place where a stranger can blend in without raising suspicion. Pleasant Valley Memorial Park is also easy to access, quiet and rarely monitored. If Joyce was looking for somewhere that she could disappear without intrusion or discovery for hours or even days, Annandale would have offered that anonymity.
Shoot, I try to disappear for days. You'd send the fuck came out after me.
Yep. Sure would.
Till I called and said, I'm okay.
Yep. It was a place where no one knew her name. And that may have been exactly the point. And it was here, amidst these tiny, innocent graves, that Joyce, the self-described Target child, laid down her plastic sheet. Next to her was the 8-inch artificial Christmas tree. And that little artificial Christmas tree carries symbolism that investigators have never been able to overlook.
She was in a children's cemetery, and it was a tiny tree.
Yep.
Big enough for BBs.
Maybe.
I'm just speculating here.
Right, right. Because they don't know.
Right.
Why.
That's just my opinion.
Right, right. So Christmas trees are childhood icons, right? Symbols of safety, belonging, and family rituals. But an artificial tree, small enough to be carried in a backpack, is different. It's a stand-in for real connection, a manufactured version of a holiday built around togetherness. For someone who felt like a permanent outsider in her own family, it was a painfully fitting emblem. She brought with her a piece of the holiday she could control, a tree that asked for nothing in return.
It's sad because she's there with all the babies.
I don't mean to laugh, but your face.
It's sad because she's laying there with all the babies.
Mm-hmm. So along with that Christmas tree, she also had a Walkman nearby her. And in the Walkman, she was playing a Mel Brooks and Carl Reiner's 2,000-year-old man routine.
Those two girls ever.
The extreme emotional contrast of seeking laughter in her final moments. There was also a backpack which contained two other specific dates, Jeff Foxworthy's You Might Be a Redneck, and a recording of the movie Monty Python and the Holy Grail. She chose absurdity and comedy to accompany her to the very end. And some believe that she chose comedy because it was the one emotional space that didn't hurt. It was the last defense mechanism of the target child, a final deliberate effort to replace pain and memory with controlled, manufactured laughter in the quiet darkness of the cemetery.
I have nothing to say. At least she's got good taste in comedy. I mean, come on. Monty Python?
I cannot.
Jeff Foxworthy?
I cannot with you.
And Mel Brooks. That's hilarious. Now, see, that's the Mel Brooks of my time. You know, when I...
At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
Was growing up, and they were hilarious.
I can't with you.
What? I'm just telling the truth.
Okay.
And I know you've watched Monty Python.
I don't know.
You've never watched Monty Python and the Holy Grail?
Probably not. I don't know. I watched Jeff Foxworthy.
You like peanut butter?
Anyway, moving on. So her death was ruled a suicide by suffocation.
What'd she do? Wrap herself up in that plastic sheet?
I'm going to tell you.
Okay.
She had ingested alcohol and Valium and then placed a plastic bag over her head and secured it in place with a wide industrial grade masking tape, ensuring her death would come.
So she drank herself to sleep.
With the Valium.
With the Valium and the alcohol.
And well, she wasn't asleep.
She'd been asleep between the Valium and the alcohol.
Yeah, but she put the bag on her head first.
Well, like, you didn't let me finish.
My
and then
bad.
She just kind of breathed herself to death.
Yeah.
Or couldn't breathe herself to death.
Right, right.
That's a horrible way to go.
Mm-hmm. Her blood alcohol content was later determined to be 0.14.
Oh, she was drunk.
Ensuring in her pockets, she left two $50 bills, which she designated as a, quote, private funeral fund. A final attempt to purchase complete anonymity and control. There was also a handwritten note signed, quote, Jane Doe, requesting no autopsy and ordering a cremation.
Damn.
The note was brief, simple, and cold, asking the police to simply dispose of her, offering the cash as payment for the service. And the immediate scene spoke of profound control. She was neatly dressed in a teal Eddie Bauer hooded jacket, a blue sweater, red silk shirt, and blue knit pants. But even her attire was part of the plan. Investigators noted that while the clothing was all brand name, every single item was meticulously devoid of any laundry or cleaning, dry cleaning bags, or other personal marks.
Well, yeah, so they could figure out where she got dry cleaned. They could tell her who she
right.
was.
She ensured no commercial trail could be gleaned from her final wardrobe. It appeared that she had spent years collecting her final presentation, ensuring the only trace of her identity was the one she intentionally left, the symbolic power of the scene itself.
She knew what she wanted.
Yeah. She had even wore a medical alert tag etched with, quote, no code, DNR, no penicillin. No penicillin.
What did you mean she wore penicillin?
Right.
Hell, that kind of killed her.
Yeah. So this was a final firm instruction about how her body should be treated, even in death. Further examination revealed that she also carried an 8-inch scar on her abdomen, possibly from a C-section, a cruel physical irony for a woman who had never had children.
They don't know if she'd never had children because they didn't know who she was.
Not at that point. And we know who she is today. So that would have been a fact that had come out after they figured out who she was.
But it still doesn't mean she didn't have children. The child could have died, been stillborn. You know?
Right. But there would still be record of that. Yep. There are no records of her ever having children in any capacity. But she has this aided scar.
But they could have given her had a hysterectomy done.
Right.
And that back then, that was the same procedure as a C-section.
Right.
Who knows?
Yep, that was part of the mystery. So, in this, there was no detail that was too small, obviously, because they had no idea who this woman was. The 8-inch artificial Christmas tree was subjected to a forensic examination. Could you imagine being that forensic examiner? Having to forensically examine a fucking 8-inch Christmas tree?
That's a lot of detail.
That's what I'm saying. Oh, I'd be so mad. Like, I'm going homesick.
Not it.
I got the Rona today. Not doing it. Okay, anyway. So investigators sought to determine its manufacturer, year of production, and point of sale. However, the tree was found to be a common mass-produced item sold nationwide over many years, rendering the lead useless and further confirming the deliberate generic nature of the items that she had used.
It's 3:03.
Yeah, I'm watching it. I got the time on my phone.
Okay.
Standard investigative procedures required submitting her fingerprints and detail records to national databases. Because she was never officially reported missing and likely lacked any law enforcement history, these essential identifiers yielded no matches. So literally everything that they thought was a lead was nothing.
They couldn't a dead end.
Yeah, they couldn't do shit with it. Yeah.
Kind of like cops on TV.
So furthermore, the initial 1996 investigation was later criticized for failing to secure high-quality post-mortem photographs, which severely hampered early efforts to create a detailed, accurate image for public circulation.
Well, why didn't they take pictures? That's almost standard procedure.
They took some, but they weren't very good. They weren't detailed.
What city was this in? What city was
Alabama? This was in Alabama.
Okay.
Annandale?
Go on.
One is the 90s. Okay, that's part of it.
I was too busy taking care of you.
They were still using fucking Polaroids and shit back then. The 90s. That's part of the problem. The other part of the problem was probably the opposite.
Yeah, they weren't well trained in a lot of it.
Right. They knew to take pictures, but
they didn't know the quality.
What is known now. They need to be very clear. You have to have a picture of everything. Yep. Close up, far away. You know, they didn't know any of that then.
The entire scene, the surroundings.
Right.
Just.
And they got a lot of criticism for that.
What?
Which.
If this was a small town, I get it.
Right.
It's not like the bigger cities where they've got more equipment to.
And it happens more often.
Right. So you got to give them that much.
Right. Virginia, not Alabama.
Huh?
Virginia, not Alabama. What the fuck am I talking about Alabama for? Let me see. It's a suburb of Washington. It's in Fairfax County.
In Virginia?
Mm-hmm.
Up by Washington, D.C.
Yeah.
So it's a border town. So
Yeah.
It's a small town.
That's all I'm looking at. I don't know why I didn't include that. Somewhere between 42,000 to 43,000.
Considering. That would probably be a small town because if they're in Fairfax.
And that was now, not in 96. So it's probably even smaller then.
But yeah, it's probably a smaller town.
Right. Yeah. And a lot of small towns just don't know how to handle a lot of
things. They don't have the equipment. And
yeah, especially in the 90s.
Right.
Yep. So her self-erasure was complete, right? She was a ghost in every system that they had checked. She became Fairfax County Jane Doe, UP6279. The anonymity she sought was starkly symbolized by the simple temporary marker placed in the cemetery. Quote, Jane Doe, 1996, which was the only name that she would have for the next 25 years. The only way to know her, the investigators realized, would be to find someone looking for a woman who did not want to be found. This necessity led investigators to begin the painstakingly process of looking into the past. So the woman was Joyce Marilyn Meyer, born July 20th of 1927 in Davenport, Iowa.
Nice.
Mm-hmm. Friends and former coworkers later described Joyce as a warm, intelligent, and quietly ambitious. She was the kind of woman who blended into a room until she spoke, and then people listened. She had a dry sense of humor, a sharp mind for detail, and a deep creative streak that came out in her writing. She was highly educated, having graduated from Iowa State University before moving to New York City to work in the competitive advertising department of 17 Magazine in the 1950s.
Dang.
Yeah. So this placed her in the heart of the era's social and cultural ambition, a world of polish and image, directly contrasting the isolated inn that she would choose decades later. Nothing in her early adult life pointed toward the profound isolation that would define her final decade. The break with her family wasn't the result of a chaotic or unstable childhood. It was the result of emotional wounds that she carried alone and interpreted through the lens of a very different era of mental health care. But her life was consumed by deep emotional fractures, triggered in the 1950s by a psychiatrist who encouraged her to blame her family for her trauma, leading to a total mental break.
That doesn't sound right.
Yep. So up until that point, she was fine. This advice, given during an era when mental health counseling was still evolving, led Joyce to believe her only path to peace was absolute alienation. She married and divorced, keeping both a secret. She never had children. The man she married was Clarence Somers, and her marriage to him and their quiet divorce added yet another layer of private history that was never shared with her siblings, cementing her isolation. The final split with her siblings had come around 1981. Joyce was either 53 or 54 at the time, and she had last seen her siblings in Tucson, Arizona. She was desperate for help, but when they couldn't assist her, she vanished. Her family, fearing that she had joined a cult, had even hired a private investigator to find her, but that effort failed. Years later, her brother, Larry Meyer, found her abandoned trailer, but he didn't find her. He did, however, find four copies of a manuscript that she had written. The title, The Target Child. Larry read that manuscript, which offered a chilling, painful explanation for her voluntary disappearance. It was an autobiographical account of deep perceived abuse. The manuscript itself wasn't a traditional memoir. It was written more like a psychological case study of her own life. It was detached, analytical, and deeply self-critical. She described patterns of feeling scapegoated, overlooked, and misunderstood, framing them as evidence of a lifelong emotional targeting.
She must have been the middle child.
I'm not sure. I couldn't figure that out.
A lot of your middle children, or
right,
however you want to say it.
They kind of get pushed to the wayside for lack of better
words. You got the oldest, who's the firstborn. Then you got the baby.
Right. Yeah.
So,
in my case, it was the oldest.
That's a whole other story.
Right. We won't get into that today. So the writing in the memoir was dense, almost clinical at times, in fact. as if she were documenting her own unraveling from a distance.
Wow.
The fact that she made 4 copies suggests that she wanted the story perceived, even if she couldn't bear to hand it to anyone directly. This was the only place where she had allowed her pain to exist without apology. This confirmed her self-perception as a woman defined by deep, unresolved childhood wounds. Crucially, despite the family's private search, because Joy was an adult who had intentionally separated herself, she was never officially reported as a missing person with law enforcement at the time. So this means that when she disappeared in Virginia as a Jane Doe in 1996, there was no matching missing persons file. So her self-erasure was complete. There was absolutely nothing.
In other words,
nothing.
Hiding in plain sight.
Right. There was nothing that they could use to try to identify her. Nothing. This tragic context explains her final choice, the children's burial section and the Christmas tree. It was a final symbolic gesture, a plea for peace for the target child that she believed she still was. The day of her discovery, just days before Christmas, gave the entire scene a heartbreaking, iconic meaning. The holiday of family togetherness was the moment she chose to be alone forever.
My heart breaks for this lady.
The 15 years between her last contact in Tucson in 1981 and her discovery in Annandale in 1996 are completely void. They have no idea what she did in between those decades.
Wow.
Well, I guess it was only one decade. Sorry. Nothing. Detectives have never been able to piece together exactly where she lived. Where she lived during those missing years. But they believe that she moved slowly across the country over time, taking cash-only jobs that would keep her from appearing in any kind of official record. There's no evidence that she stayed in Arizona and no clear indication that she had ties to Virginia before she committed suicide. Instead, investigators think that she may have lived in an internment transient lifestyle. She lived in small towns, temporary rentals, seasonal work, things like that. Always choosing places where she could disappear easily. What's most painstaking is that she left no trace behind at all. No bank account, no vehicles, no rental applications, nothing that could place her definitively in any city between 1981 and 1996.
Wow.
Yep. So if she did have children, and that's what her star was from, they have no way of knowing. Her final preparation was meticulous. Every part of her plan, right down to the industrial grade tape around the plastic bag, reflected the profound emotional wall that she had built. So she wanted to return to ash and dust, leaving no trace behind. She was 69 years old when she died, succeeding in maintaining her anonymity for the next quarter century. So for 25 years, the file for UP6279 was not closed. This cold case required a generational handoff. From the beginning, her information was logged into the federal NCIC, which is the National Crime Information Center, for anyone that does not know. It's a database that puts in information, you know, for different cases to try to link them together. And they also had a 2000 composite sketch that they circulated widely, trying to figure out who she was. Because we know who she is, but up to this point, they still didn't know who she was. So the police department had to keep waiting. The key scientific hurdle was that conventional DNA techniques in the 1990s required clean samples. The case had to wait for the invention of specialized forensic genetic genealogy, or FGG, in order to process the highly degraded remains. This expensive process required anonymous donors for funding. And the decision to fund this effort was a testament to the dedication of the Fairfax County investigators, who refused to let the victim's final wish of anonymity silence the need for her story to be known. So, in January of 2022, the Fairfax County Cold Case Squad finally partnered with Oath Ram East, Yeah. Through specialized sequencing, they built a genealogical profile. And by May 11th, 2022, the profile led directly to her surviving family.
Dang.
The identification process was deeply human. When detectives located her sister, Annette Meyer Law, and they showed her the 2000 composite sketch, Annette immediately confirmed her identity. She saw the eyes of her sister, the woman who had spent 41 years in self-imposed exile, finally looking back at her. For the detective, that confirmation was more than a procedural milestone. It was the emotional conclusion to a mystery they had inherited from a previous generation. Some of them had spent years quietly revisiting the file, unable to lay at rest. For Joyce's family, the phone call was both a shock and a relief. They had lived for decades in a state of suspended grief, wondering if she was alive, homeless, hospitalized, or buried in an unmarked grave somewhere. Hearing that she had died alone in 1996 was devastating. But hearing where she was and that she had finally been found gave them the closure they never thought possible. So, our anonymous woman was Joyce Marilyn Meyer Somers. The mystery of the Christmas tree lady was solved 25 years, 4 months, 3 weeks, and 2 days later.
Dang.
Her final wish was immediate cremation, designed to ensure her anonymity. But the identification had changed everything. The work of the cold case detectives ensured that Joyce's final will, to be forgotten, was not honored. The remains of this woman who died seeking ultimate solitude were finally brought out of the shadows. And in 2022, Joyce's remains were released to her family. The woman who spent 41 years estranged and 15 years in total isolation was finally given her name back. Her siblings expressed relief, sadness, and a sense of closure after 4 decades of not knowing. Ultimately, her family decided to honor the location that she chose for herself. She was interred at Pleasant Valley Memorial Park in Annandale, Virginia, the very cemetery where she died. The target child found her final resting place, not in a family plot, but where she last felt control amidst the quiet grave that she chose.
That's kind of sad.
Yeah. Yeah, it's sad.
It is.
But you told me I couldn't ruin Christmas, so. There you go.
But I don't understand. Never mind. It just popped into my brain. Never mind.
Answered your own question?
I did.
So funny. Oh, I said that really loud. Sorry. So we know this time of year is hard for many people. And so we want to provide resources for anyone that is in need right now. So if you or someone you know is struggling with mental health, please reach out. You can contact the 988 Suicide and Crisis Lifeline by simply calling or texting 988 anytime, day or night. You can also text HOME to the crisis text line at 741741 to connect with a crisis counselor immediately. No, you don't have to face whatever you're going through alone.
Please get help.
And all of those, I will put those in the description as well. That way they're easy to find. And that's all I have for this week.
Just please get help. Don't try to do it by yourself or let it go too long. Because trust me, every one of us need help once in a while.
Mm-hmm. Yep. We all have hard times and some things are easier to deal with than others.
I've lost some friends because of this and mental health. And
yep. Mike and I, we've had several friends commit suicide themselves. We have had, you know, friends die from other things, but.
And it's hard because you, especially if they don't ask for help.
Right.
Because if they don't ask, you don't know.
Right.
Because mental illness doesn't always show itself.
That's very true. Right. So you have to ask for, whether it's a friend, family, or some counselor you don't
sometimes
know.
Even a stranger.
Right.
I was working at one of my former jobs.
Right.
And this veteran came in, and he was having
a very bad day.
I just sat and talked with him until help came for him.
Hmm. sometimes it's easier to talk to a stranger rather than
right.
someone that is in your life.
And you know what? He came back and thanked me.
Aw.
I know. So I hope if he does hear this and remembers, I got you, dude. Just like I told you that day, I got you.
He's so funny. Yeah, sometimes it's easier to talk to a stranger than it is talking to someone that is involved in your life, because you may see it, you may think that there's judgment or there's shame or, you know, one of 50 million feelings. But with a stranger, sometimes it's easier because there isn't that personal connection.
Right.
They have no.
They don't judge.
Exactly. They have no dog in the race. So how can they tell you? How would they have the right to judge you when they don't know you? So sometimes it's easier. And the 988, it's, they're real counselors. They said they talk to you on the phone. They'll text you. Same with the home text line. They're real people. Some of them are real licensed counselors that are just volunteering. All of this stuff is volunteer work. It's not, they're not paid positions. So they're actual people who
care.
Right. So do you need that, or someone that you know needs that, reach out to that. If you know someone who is struggling and you yourself need advice or help, these lines are available for you to figure out how to help them as well. It's not just because you yourself. So it's there. You can also Google. There's also other resources that, depending on where you live, that may be available
sometimes
to your specific area.
Sometimes just going to the emergency room, they
yeah.
can help you.
Yep. That's true, too. So help is out there. Don't sit and suffer alone. It doesn't help. It doesn't help you. It doesn't help your loved ones. Help is out there. You just have to ask for it. But that's all I have. Unless you have anything else.
No, I'm done. This one just hit home to me in too many places.
Right. Well, on that note, come back next Monday to join us as we travel to a remote wooden cabin deep in the mountains. A place meant for quiet retreat that became the scene of unspeakable chaos.
I love chaos.
In the spring of 1981, a horrifying tableau was discovered inside Cabin 28. Multiple victims bound and brutalized, found by a young girl returning home. The violence was so extreme, the details so baffling, that investigators were immediately confronted with a question. Was this the work of one monster or a conspiracy of silence? We'll explore the terrifying scene, the missing young girls whose disappearance added a chilling layer to the puzzle, and the single key piece of evidence, a broken tool that led nowhere. And then decades later, with broken leads and unanswered questions, this case remains one of America's most brutal unsolved family massacres. You do not want to miss this one, but as a warning, you may never look at a cute little holiday cabin the same way again.
I'm looking at cute little holiday cabins anyway. They ain't got no internet, no phone, no cable. No, I'll stay home.
And with that, we hope y'all have a great weekend. We hope you had a great Thanksgiving. Keep your Christmas spirit going. And as always,
watch out for monsters.
And don't kill people. Bye, y'all.
Bye, y'all.